Good evening and welcome to Seascapes. On tonight's programme, we'll be on board one of the Irish Sea's biggest ferries as she makes a passage to Dublin. We're sailing from Donegal to the South Hebrides, and we have the latest on Rockall. If you ever cast your eye out to Dublin Bay, you'll see car ferries coming and going to the UK at all times of the day and night. Ferry traffic is a mainstay of Dublin Port, and most of us are familiar with the comforts, the restaurants, the cabins of modern ships. But below decks, there's another world. On a crossing from Holyhead to Dublin, Radio 1's Michael Lawless got a tour of Stena Line Stena Adventurer, where he met the second engineer, Russell Haswell, below deck in the control room.
Watertight doors all the time. Part of life, just got to get used to it.
So explain the watertight door to me.
So the ship is subdivided into watertight compartments for safety in the event of flooding. But to go from one compartment to another, there's a hydraulically operated door. They're very powerful doors and you have to be very careful with them. And they're slow to operate, so you have to operate them on the handle. The bell rings and you wait for 30 seconds of life. And then you go through and you wait for another 30 seconds of life to close it again. Here we're in the engine control room, the ECR as we call it, and this is the heart of control operations for everything to do with the machinery and the engineering on board ship. So in front of us you can see there's a series of computer screens, and through that we can monitor everything the plant is doing, all the temperatures and pressures, electrical power, you know, the ship's propulsion. You'd also see there's a lot of old-fashioned type dials there. At one time those dials would have been connected with a load of copper pipework, and you know, that isn't the case anymore. It's all electrical wiring. Those are just repeating the digital signals from the computer. You can also see in the centre of the control console there, this is what's called the telegraph. So perhaps people might be familiar in the old days, you know, there was the big telegraph indicator, you know, the bell that rings ding 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 half ahead and all that. One of the things that has changed in the last sort of 20-30 years is that the bridge have direct control now, so when they push the sticks to make the ship go forward, they control the engines directly.
In old times they used to call down, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right, the old speaking tube, you know, half ahead. You see at the back of the room here, there's a large set of electrical panels, and inside of that is the computer, the automation system. And the joke is that that's the best engineer on the ship. It doesn't get tired, it doesn't get emotional, it doesn't make mistakes. It just sits and watches and controls things all the time. It's our job to make sure it does the right thing.
We're on the Irish Sea at the moment. We're heading for Dublin.
That is right.
And how is the ship performing and what are the dials we're seeing?
Right, so we've got four main engines on board the Stena Adventurer here, and they're both working more or less full percentage at the moment. So you can see the dials there are showing us things like revolutions per minute of the engines, so that's 550 revs. You can see things like the temperatures and pressures of the lubricating oil and the compressed air and the cooling water. So all of these dials have a green section in them, and so long as the pointer is inside of that green section of the dial, we know that just at a glance it's reading the correct value. And so you can see on the computer screen next to the dials, all of that is green, there's no red flashing light, and so we can see that everything's healthy, everything's working as it should.
And once an engine begins possibly to overheat, you'll start seeing a red flashing light, will you?
That's right. So as we're standing here, we might get a beeping noise, an alarm, and the computer will tell us if something goes out of range. Yeah, and that could either be, you know, something is actually wrong. It could sometimes be a sensor fault. It does happen. But yeah, the computer will tell us straight away if there's a problem to be solved, and then we can go address that.
Now, if you go onto the Stena Line website, you'll see that this boat is pretty much underwater 364 days of the year.
That's right.
What about maintenance of these engines, because you have four of them?
Okay, so one of the great strengths of this ship is that we have a lot of flexibility. We've got four engines, but we can run on three and more or less maintain the schedule. So in terms of like major maintenance, when we have to take an engine down for, we take all the pistons out and rebuild the thing, we can maintain schedule with a little bit of, 5-10 minutes delay here and there. But with the three engines working hard, we can more or less maintain it. A lot of the day-to-day maintenance, the more incidental stuff, the regular stuff, we can do that in the few hours we have in port. And every day we have 2-3 hours in Dublin in the evenings, and so we can get a lot done with planning and with teamwork, which is really important. We can do most things alongside in Dublin.
You mentioned teamwork because you're not the only person here in the engine room. So tell me about maybe the team that you will have in the engine room.
Okay, so at the top of the tree we have the chief engineer, and he's my boss. Very, very nice chap he is too, because I have to say that. And then we have, because it's a 24-hour operation, we have a chief engineer and we have there's the alarm.
Okay, do you want to tell me what's happened?
So that alarm was just the computer saying that it's detected a minor fault on the electrical wiring, and it's cleared again. So if that happens again, we'll eventually find where the fault is, but it's nothing to worry about.
Okay,
yeah, so we have a chief engineer during the day. We also have what's called the night chief engineer. So he covers the night hours as the boss. Then there's myself, the second engineer, who's sort of the day-to-day boss, you might say. And then we have four what we call watchkeeping engineers. So they work a rotating shift pattern, working 12 hours at a time. And they work midnight, midday, midday, midnight, or 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. And that's as a rolling shift pattern. And it's their job to be here to do all of what we call watchkeeping, maintaining and monitoring the plant and doing any incidental work that and some of the plant maintenance work as well. And on top of that, we also have two electricians, and they support us all the time with their kind of specialist expertise in electrical work as well.
Now, Russell, I'd normally ask you to show me the engine room, but we're currently running, and it's extremely loud in there, as I found, so I won't be able to report. So you might tell me a little bit about the engines and the four of them that you have in there.
Right. So if we go through the door into the edge room, what we see is the port side engine room. So we have two main engines in there, and everything is duplicated on the starboard side. We have large four-stroke engines. So there are 9 cylinders each, and they're about 7,500 horsepower each. Two engines will drive into a large mechanical gearbox, and that steps the speed down. So that steps the rotational speed from 550 revolutions per minute down to 150 revolutions per minute to the propeller. So then after the gearbox, you've got a long propeller shaft, and then you've got at the end what's called a controllable pitch propeller. So people might be more familiar perhaps with aircraft propellers. They spin at the same speed and they change the pitch, the angle on the blades of the propeller. And we have the same system, it's just on a much grander scale. So it means you can keep the propeller turning the same speed all of the time, and we just vary the speed of the ship by changing the pitch of the propeller blades. And also we can go backwards, we can run astern as well by putting negative pitch on. In the engine room, what you'll see that surrounds the engine room is all the things that we need, all the bits of ancillary and auxiliary machinery we need to feed the beast in the centre of the engine room. So an awful lot of our effort is supplying fuel to the engines, because the fuel we have is what's called residual fuel, which you take your crude oil from the ground, you take all the refinery takes all the petrol, the diesel, the lubricating oil, all the good stuff out of it, and then we're left with the residue at the bottom of the stack, and it's a very thick black oil. So we have to clean that before we can burn it. So we have a whole series of plant that cleans and filters the fuel, and then we deliver that to the engine hot and, you know, runny, ready to inject into the cylinders. But we also have to provide things like cooling, so with that comes heat exchangers and all the cooling pumps that surround around the engine. One of the side effects of burning heavy fuel is the lubricating oil inside the engine becomes quite dirty, so we have to clean and filter the lubricating oil, so we have all the ancillary machinery for that, there's also surrounds the engine. So the although you've got the enormous machine in the middle, all the space around it is crammed with machinery that services that one thing. Yeah.
Let's talk about steering the ship.
Okay, so the ship is steered by the large rudders at the back end. It's hydraulically actuated, so there's a lot of powerful hydraulic units. When the ship is being manoeuvred in and out of port, the bridge, the navigation officers up there, they're actively controlling that. They're steering the ship in an active way. Once the ship is on passage, that is more controlled by an automatic pilot. So they will plot the course, and the ship will follow the course automatically. So in the old days of having somebody permanently standing at the wheel, receiving orders all of the time, that's long since it's gone. Again, the computer is in charge, but the navigator is always there on the bridge, ready to take over in the event of the unexpected. One of the challenges of having a ship with like 1,500 people on board is we have all the challenges of a small town. So that includes things like providing hot and cold fresh water, sewage collection, sewage treatment and drainage. So we'll go to the forward machinery space now, and we'll see a little bit of the plant that supports the passengers and the hotel. So we're now in what is literally the bowels of the ship. We don't get any lower than this. We're in what's called the pipe tunnel. And on our right-hand side, you can see all of the fuel tanks. We can store about 1,500 tons of fuel. On the left-hand side, you can see all of the ballast tanks that help keep the ship upright. Yeah. And so you can see right down the length of most of the ship here with all the pipework for fuel and ballast and steam heating and things running.
I suppose, Russell, we're in an era where we're more mindful of fuel and global warming. And I'm wondering, what savings do you do on board to ensure you don't waste fuel and to minimise it where possible?
Yeah, this is one of these cases where commercial goals go hand in hand with environmental goals. Fuel is expensive, so waste is more cost. So it's in our interest. So in terms of the operation, we have a schedule to keep. We can leave port and we can go as fast as we can and get there early, but that's a waste of fuel. So what we'll do is we will reduce speed to arrive on time at the scheduled time. That keeps the customers happy, and it means we're not wasting fuel. And it means you're working in partnership with the wind and the tide and the waves with you. Well, Michael, that ends the tour of the machinery spaces of the Stena Adventurer. We'll be in port in Dublin in about an hour and a quarter's time, and wish you a safe onward journey.
Brilliant. Thanks very much for a tour for Seascapes.
Thanks to Michael Lawless on board the Stena Adventurer with engineer Russell Haswell. Now the tiny outcrop of Rockall crashed back into the news for the first time since the 70s last week, when Scotland warned Irish fishing vessels against fishing there. The move caused shock and anger among Irish fishermen, and I spoke to Sean O'Donoghue of the Killybegs Fishman Organisation, who told me about feelings in Killybegs.
We were absolutely shocked and dumbfounded when we were officially informed, it was only a week ago, last Friday, that the Scottish authorities were going to declare a 12-mile zone around Rockall and enforce it as such, which we consider is an illegal act on their behalf and is contrary to the CFP and the United Nations Law of the Sea Convention.
Do you know where this came from?
Absolutely not. I know that from an Irish government point of view that this is an ongoing dispute that has been going on with the Irish government and the UK government, and in the last 2 years with the Scottish administration, because they got devolved control of fisheries after the Scottish referendum, which was held, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, as such. So this has been an ongoing dispute, and we were absolutely surprised. So all we can surmise at this stage is that it is the SNP, who are a very pro-European party, and have been only this week out in Brussels with Michel Barnier, trying to see how they can stay to be part of the European Union.
So a tactic on their part, a political tactic on their part, you think?
I think so, because the Conservatives have been very pro the stance of the Scottish fishing industry in terms of getting their waters back, and I think they're losing some ground on the fishing communities in Scotland. So I think this was their way of showing that they were even more that they were even better than the Conservatives on this.
How far away is Rockall from Killybegs?
I think that's the key point here, is that there's been a lot of misinformation over the last week, and there's been a lot of so-called experts who aren't really experts in relation to this. In terms of Rockall, we are the nearest point from Donegal to Rockall is 229 nautical miles.
Not 240.
Not 200. Well, sorry, to be 200 a nautical mile is more than an actual natural mile. So in miles, it probably is 240. But the exclusive economic area, the 200 miles is actually 200 nautical miles. It is not land based miles as such. So no matter what we. What point we take from the Donegal coast, we can't generate an exclusive economic area that comes within the 200 miles, whereas the nearest point from Scotland, which is the Outer Hebrides, Kilda, is about 169 nautical miles. So they have, way back in 77, when the 200 mile limits were adopted, we would have adopted our 200 miles. They would have adopted theirs. Rockall came within theirs, and we have never, either at official level or at industry level, we've never disputed that the Rock was actually within the UK 200 mile limit. But what we have vehemently been against is that the UK declaring a 12-mile zone around Rockall, because it's an uninhabited island, and under UNCLOS and indeed under the CFP, they can't do that.
So it is actually more complicated than the British Navy landing there in the 1950s and claiming it for the Queen.
To be perfectly honest, the British Navy landing in 1955, and I think we had an attempt as well in 1975. Both of those are an irrelevancy, because the 200 mile EEZs, which were agreed in under UNCLOS, didn't come into effect until 77. So you have to look at this from 77 on. And another point that's misread here is that the UK are saying, oh, we have national legislation about an exclusive zone around Rockall. They may very well have national legislation, but that's an irrelevancy, because they're still part of the EU, and the EU law supersedes national law where there is a contradiction.
How important are the waters around Rockall for Irish charters?
They are pretty important, particularly for two species, for haddock, which is a quota species, and for squid, which is a non-quota species. And obviously, when you have an outcrop like that in the middle of the Atlantic, you will get congregations of fish there. So fishing inside the 12-mile limit, you know, we've done this for years, both inside and outside as such. So I would say certainly for some of our vessels that operate out of Killybegs and operate out of Greencastle, you're talking in the region that they would be generating in the region of 20-30% of their grossings or their income from Rockall.
Is it very rough up there? I'd imagine it is. And does that mean then the fishing is seasonal?
Absolutely. I think people need to realize that we're talking about 229 nautical miles from Donegal to get out to the Rock. So it really is only, it is from May to September is when the majority of the vessels would be fishing there. You'd get the odd vessel, maybe one or two vessels that would fish outside of that period. But generally, it is a good weather fishery because you can get some really bad weather there. And to be honest, our whitefish vessels are not very large that actually operate out there.
What do you think the Irish government should do? Would it help to send up a few naval ships?
No, I think that would be absolutely the wrong thing to do at this stage, because as I can see, and we advocated it as well, is that this has to be resolved at a diplomatic level. And I am glad to say that both the Scottish and the Irish authorities and governments are now dealing with it on the diplomatic level. And I would hope that a solution can be found in relation to this. Sending the Navy up there, or indeed the Scottish sending vessels out there enforcing what we consider an illegal act, would be highly provocative on either side. So we certainly don't want that. We have had really good relationships, and still do, with our Scottish fishermen on the ground, and we want to maintain those as such.
Sean O'Donoghue of the Killybegs Fishermen's Organisation. And staying in that part of the world, a new charter sailing company has started up in Foyle called Sailing North. Lorna Siggins sailed on one of their trips, maybe it was a peace trip, from Derry to Scotland.
Every day that you sail into a harbour to the sound of bagpipes and the sizzle of scallops being cooked on the quay by a member of the HM Coast Guard. But then this is the South Hebridean island of Islay, where Derry skipper Dan Gallagher is very well known. Dan, who grew up on the banks of the Foyle, spent much of his life in the shellfish business, but he also has 30,000 nautical miles and more of sailing under his belt, and he was formerly selected to represent Ireland in the Admiral's Cup. He and his wife Rona have recently acquired Coriolis, a Sweden Yachts 42 design, for charter and sail training trips with their company Sailing North. Dan is a qualified RYA instructor, and with his trusty crew, including pelagic fisherman Francie Kavanagh, Alton Galvin Hospital nurse Kim Banks, and Keenanish own sailor Trish Hegarty, I took a 7-hour trip from the Foyle to the Southern Hebrides, where we were met by piper and hotelier Nigel Morris, Port Ellen Harbour Association Chairman Gus Newman, and Chef cum Coast Guard Officer Harold Hastie.
Nigel Morris.
And where are you from?
I'm from Islay.
Islay?
No, not Islay, Islay.
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 And you're going to play something now for the Coriolis that's just sailed in.
If I have to, I will.
Okay, on you go. So, Harold, what are you doing here? Apart from eating?
Trying to eat a hot scallop.
Okay, and do you normally cook scallops for every boat?
Oh, for every boat that comes in, yeah, and we fill them up with whiskey.
Okay, and this is your job with the HM Coast Guard?
Yes.
In Port Ellen?
To rescue them.
Okay.
That's it.
Good morning. We're on board our yacht Coriolis here in Port Ellen in the end of Islay, Scotland, one of the Hebridean Islands. She's a Sweden Yachts 42 and built in Sweden. She's built in 2007, and she's a sloop rig with roller furling, head sail and slab reefing mainsail, which is very easy to manage and safer for the crew. We don't have a lot of deck work to do because of it. She's full coated spec for safety to MCA standard, with all of the EPIRBs and safety equipment, etc. on board.
Take the main sheet, which is the forward blue one.
Yeah.
Transferred onto this drum here.
How do you keep your tip there?
Right, just bring the main on first. I think she might.
We left Greencastle in a brisk northerly, and that meant we slept very well that night in Port Ellen. And after breakfast the next day of monkfish tails wrapped in bacon and poached eggs, cooked up by Francie Kavanagh, who's no mean chef when he's not thinking about his valet Blacknoll sheep backing in his own, we visited the monument at Oa, which is dedicated to American sailors who lost their lives in several sinkings off Islay in the final year of the First World War. There, Islay resident Fraser Morrison explained to us the significance of the monument, and he also spoke to us about Islay's Tara, as in Finlaggan, former seat of the Lord of the Isles and Clan Donald. And he also spoke to us about whisky.
My name's Fraser Morrison, and I grew up in Islay. So we're here at the American Monument down the O, and it commemorates the lives of the American soldiers that were lost in the ships here. Finlaggan on Islay would be in the ruins of a kingdom that would have ruled most of the west and the north of Scotland and Ireland at one point. And I suppose it kind of reflects the cultural kind of overlap between the areas that still exist now.
And if you go on Netflix...
If you were to watch Outlaw King on Netflix, that'll explain part of it. They visit Islay in that drama, which is apparently is very quite historically accurate about the life of Robert the Bruce.
And do they speak much Gaelic here? In
a little bit, yeah. I think it's not as common as it would have been maybe a generation ago, but you know, you'll still meet a lot of people here that'll speak, I suppose we would call it Gaelic, but it's just a dialect.
And distilleries, the big employment.
Yeah, the whisky. The whisky's the water of life. It's the big thing here. Yeah, so the real distinctive peaty taste that brings people in from all over the world.
Guillemots and gannets had kept us company at sea, and we spotted golden eagles and buzzards and pheasants on Islay as we passed through peat bogs and woodlands carpeted in bluebells. Before we left, we also visited another monument at Sanaghmore, which remembers 241 Irish emigrants, including 63 children, who lost their lives on April the 28th, 1847, when a ship bound from Derry for Quebec was caught in a storm. But there's so much to do and see on Islay. There's also Jura and its paps, separated by a very narrow channel. We had to head home, though, with a lovely wind to carry the sea-kind Coriolis back to the Foyle.
Belfast Coast Guard, Coriolis, routine traffic, over.
Coriolis, Belfast Coast Guard, 6-7, stand by, please, over.
Coriolis, Belfast Coast Guard.
Now, good afternoon, Belfast, Coriolis, departing Port Ellen Islay for Greencastle, Loch Foyle, 6 POATs on board, ETA, Greencastle, 1800 hours, over.
This is Belfast Coast Guard, all four seas, so many thanks, safe passage, Belfast out.
And you can find more details about Sailing North on their website, sailingnorth.co.uk. And that's it for Seascapes for this week. We're back at the same time next Friday. Everything on the programme is podcast and on our website, rte.ie/seascapes. If you're on the water over the next week, be safe.